From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, growing up around Alaska's pimps, prostitutes, gamblers, and con men, we talk with Kim Rich. Her father was one of Anchorage's most notorious underworld figures during that city's oil boom years. Rich is a journalist and has written a memoir about her father. Also, a talk with actor Ed Harris. He played a mercenary in Under Fire, astronaut John Glenn in The Right Stuff, and now he's an FBI agent in the new movie The Firm. And world music critic Milo Miles tells us about a new form of merengue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court ruled today that giving minorities a majority in redrawn congressional districts may violate white voters' rights. The decision revives a challenge to a North Carolina plan that created two majority black districts. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Writing for the five-member court majority, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor described the district as a snake in shape, 160 miles long and no wider than the interstate corridor it stretched along. The district was created by North Carolina officials after the Justice Department insisted that not one but two majority black districts should be created under the Voting Rights Act. Five white citizens challenged the plan in court, claiming it was a racial gerrymander in violation of the Constitution's guarantee to equal protection of the law. A lower court dismissed the claim, but today the Supreme Court reinstated it, setting out broad new criteria for states to meet in proving that such districts are compelled in order to eradicate the effects of past discrimination. North Carolina must now prove that it has met these criteria if it wants to keep its second districting plan intact. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
Iraq lodged an official protest with the UN Security Council today, charging that the United States was guilty of state terrorism and blackmail in yesterday's cruise missile attack on Baghdad. The protest came a day after the United States briefed the Security Council on the evidence it says proves that Iraq was behind the plot to assassinate former President Bush in Kuwait. The president's decision to attack boosted his approval ratings, even though three of the missiles went astray and killed some civilians. The National Commission on AIDS released its final report this morning, saying lack of leadership and national planning have been the biggest stumbling blocks in the fight against AIDS. The commission now goes out of business after 4 years of work. NPR's Chitra Raghavan has more.
Over and over again at the news conference this morning, commission members spoke emotionally about what they believe is at the core of the failure to stop the spread of AIDS. Mary Fisher, a commission member who herself is infected with the AIDS virus, called upon President Clinton to set to rest the fears of the AIDS communities.
We are desperate for national leadership in the arena of AIDS. Where once there was hope perhaps too great or expectations perhaps too high, now there is suspicion, perhaps too deep. The air in the AIDS community is thick with the fear of broken promises.
Commission members said in their 4 years of traveling around the country, they have seen people with AIDS suffer enormous pain and discrimination. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 39 points to close at 3,530. This is NPR. The Israeli army said today that its troops killed two Hezbollah guerrillas in a gunfight in South Lebanon. The fight took place north of the area that Israel calls its security zone. An Israeli spokesman said the skirmish took place after five rockets were fired from South Lebanon into Israeli territory, slightly injuring six people. Israel and its South Lebanese militia also shelled guerrilla-held areas in the regions. Clashes also continued in the Gaza Strip today, where Palestinians said that Israeli troops shot and wounded a 10-year-old Arab boy. There's been another arson attack on foreigners living in Germany. This time, the victims were a Moroccan family. One woman was injured and the house was partially destroyed. Lynn Weil reports from Bonn.
A 31-year-old woman, the mother of five, passed out from inhaling the smoke in her burning home near the city of Düsseldorf in western Germany early this morning. She was found on the ground and taken to a hospital where she was treated for smoke inhalation injuries. Her sister and children escaped from the blaze by climbing down a ladder from the second floor. The family had just moved back home after a fire 2 weeks ago in which someone painted a swastika on the wall. Investigators believe the attack today was also racially motivated and are sure it was arson. In the past month, there have been at least 40 arson attacks on the homes of foreigners in Germany, which investigators have attributed to right-wing extremists. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil in Bonn.
On a close vote today, the House moved to end the selective service system. The system requires 18-year-old men to register for possible military service. Today's 207-202 vote came during debate on a bill that would provide $5 million to wind up the system's activities. The Clinton administration had asked for $29 million to keep the selective service system running. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To most of us in the lower 48, growing up in Anchorage, Alaska is a pretty exotic idea in and of itself. My guest Kim Rich grew up in Anchorage, and her father was one of that city's most notorious underworld figures. For a long time, her father's FBI rap sheet was the only recorded family history she had. Her father was murdered in 1973. Kim was 15. Years after the investigation of his murder, she conducted her own investigation into her family history. She's written a memoir about growing up in Alaska's underworld called Johnny's Girl. Now she's a journalist and divides her time between Alaska and New York, where she's in the graduate creative writing program at Columbia University. She told me how her father made a living when she was growing up.
When my parents moved, well, before they moved to Alaska, my father, from the research I was able to dig up, was in California, moving between San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego. And according to his rap sheet, he was picked up in just about every city as a burglary suspect, which, as I write in the book, back in those days, that was something they could, you know, pick someone up, charge him with that just to hold him for a few days. So it's not clear to me exactly what he was doing in those cities. My guess is he was probably gambling, running around in the gambling scenes. He might have been fencing stolen property. When he came to Alaska in 58, initially he sold cars for a while. He always had some legitimate enterprise on the side going, but mostly he gambled. He started running after our gambling houses. Then he took over a hotel called the Safari in the early 60s, ran it for a bail bondsman who owned it. And from what I understand, that was where the streetwalkers would go. It was in the heart of Anchorage's downtown sort of red light district. Then he continued to basically run after ours gambling houses all the way up until the time of his death in the early 70s. And before his death, he was then running massage parlors, which were basic fronts for houses of prostitution.
He had one club that he called Le Pussycat, and his
right.
ads,
oh, right.
his ads had the Tom Jones song,
right.
What's New Pussycat in it?
Isn't that great?
Yeah. Would you describe that club?
Yeah, that was one of his legitimate enterprises. I think if my father could do things in the way he probably really wanted to do them, he would have been a music promoter, and he tried to do that for a while, and the nightclub was part of that aspiration. He loved popular music, and that was a club he took over when I was about 9. It was called the North Starlight Lounge. He named it the Le Pussycat. I don't know where he got the name. But it was a nice club as far as nightclubs in Anchorage go. It was a large, boxy building, but on the inside it had a stage and a big bar and a nice mural on one wall. And they used to have these groups that back then, these sort of small, quasi-Las Vegas-style bands that would, you know, you had guys playing the instrument and then two or three women who would front for the band and would dance, you know, in these scantily clad costumes and would eventually take off all their clothes by the end of the set. And I remember I would go there when I was in fifth grade at the time. I would sometimes get to go there at night, and I loved it. It was a great place to be as a kid. It seemed all very exciting and glamorous to me. But I remember they would do songs like, you know, Ike and Tina Turner hits, and the women would come out. They would do, Paul Revere and the Raiders songs, and the women would wear Indian headdresses and fringed bikini bottoms and that sort of thing. Or they would carry muskets sort of for some Minutemen, kind of the English invasion thing.
So what did you make of this as a young girl? You know, staying up late nights, being in your father's club, seeing gambling, seeing prostitutes, seeing showgirls.
Well, I had an... depending on what the enterprise was and at what point in my life I was being exposed to it, at different times it was, you know, going to the nightclub was very exciting. I could stay up late and there was colored lights and live music and it was very engaging. There were other times later when I was 13 and my father was running an after-hours gambling house in my home that it wasn't so great, because what it meant for me was that every morning at around 5 a.m., the downstairs of my house became a bar. And there was a lot of cigarette smoke and a lot of noise, and it would wake me up. And things like, I have natural curly hair, and I was wearing these giant hair rollers at the time to take the kinks out of my hair. And being 13, I was very vain, and I didn't dare go downstairs with rollers in my hair. So I'd get up in the morning, and I'd have to use the bathroom, and I'd have to run around my room trying to get the curlers out of my hair just to go downstairs to go to the bathroom. And that often meant standing in line with people just to get into my own bathroom. I didn't like it then.
Your mother was a bar girl and a prostitute during parts of her life. How old were you when you found that out?
The book began as a newspaper series for the Anchorage Daily News, and so when I began the research for them, for the series, I think that's when I first learned what exactly it was she'd been doing in the early 60s in Anchorage. You know, the book is really sort of broken down into thirds, and the first third is my life with my parents from birth until age six. And it was during those years she was a B-girl and an occasional prostitute. From what I understand, this wasn't the thing she did most often, but did perhaps occasionally. And as a child, I had no idea what it was she did. I just know that she went to work at night, and every night at around 8 or 9 o'clock, she would get dressed up in cocktail dresses and high heels and would go out, and we had live-in sitters who would stay with me. So I didn't really, again, have a sense of what it was she did then. When I learned later, it didn't strike me as anything so surprising or awful. In fact, there had always been this sort of secrecy surrounding my mother's life and even her death. And I, as much as I could understand that as a small child, I knew that she wasn't well, because later when she had her first collapse, her mental illness collapse, I knew something was wrong with her, but I didn't know what. I remember when I got her, when I was speaking with a clinic, a records person at this clinic where she had stayed, and they told me my mother had been schizophrenic and that she had worked as a prostitute. The two thoughts that went through my mind is, that's it? That's what everyone has been hiding all these years? They just didn't seem that awful to me.
But what exactly would you have to do as a B-girl or a bar girl?
Mostly they were high-priced cocktail waitresses. They would sit at a bar and, encourage men to buy drinks and would get a commission for the drinks they sold. There's still some B-girl activity that goes on probably in every state. It's a thing that liquor commissions are still trying to chase down and eradicate. They also, from what I understand, you know, they would dance with the men. They would flirt with them. I wrote about in the book there were rooms in the back. They would sometimes take them to do, you know, heaven knows what, probably all kinds of things. Mostly they would just sit at the bar and get them to buy drinks. There's a picture in the book that a former B-girl friend of my mother's had and gave me. It's very striking to me because there's about, if I remember correctly, there's about a half dozen women sitting at the bar there, and they all look like your mother. They're all wearing, you know, high neckline sweaters and pearls. You know, they don't look like harlots, and they certainly don't look like streetwalkers.
It's funny you should say they all look like your mother. I mean, it was your mother.
Right, I know. These were, so they were sort of a cross between a cocktail waitress and a working girl, and it's not clear to me how many of them actually worked as prostitutes and how many just sold the drinks.
Your mother was institutionalized when you were young. When she got out of the hospital, she left your father. She bought two one-way tickets to Chicago and moved you to Ironwood, Michigan, her hometown. And you spent a couple of years there. Your mother was institutionalized again, so she wasn't home very much. And then, surprisingly, your father applied for custody. How much of a surprise was it for you when your father wanted to take you back with him to Alaska?
It was a relief at the time. Perhaps the hardest chapter in the book to write was the chapter on my years in Ironwood. in part because I have a lot of conflicted feelings about that, and it was a very painful period. In part because the people who I was living with at the time, my mother's family, are still living, and I wanted to bring some context to what I was going to say about them and about my years there. And in short, it's pretty simple to understand. I went from being with both my parents and living in a rather stable, if you will, home environment and loving environment to, at the age of six, being thrust into the world of strangers and relatives, and my mother having had her breakdown and my father living thousands of miles away. I was not happy about this as a six-year-old, seven-year-old, or eight-year-old, and perhaps no small child would be. I think that, you know, my mother's family, as I write about in the book, they did probably the best they could. When my father, but I was very unhappy there, and when I finally learned that he had gotten custody of me, and it was just announced to me one day, I mean, I had no inkling that this was coming. I was thrilled to be leaving Arnwood. I didn't like it there. I wanted to be with him. And I couldn't, you know, I wanted to be with my mother, but I certainly couldn't be with her because she wasn't well. So I was very happy about that prospect.
So your father came and got you, took you back to Alaska with him. He was still involved in all these illegal activities. And he would leave you alone at night. You know, when the Tonight Show came on, he'd go to his club or whatever, and you'd be alone. Was that really frightening?
It was lonely. And it could be frightening. You know, small children have very active imaginations. And, you know, I being no different, you know, for me, the monsters under my bed seemed more real, perhaps, than they did for other children who had parents down the hall. But I got used to it. I never liked it. But I did get used to it. To this day, I tend to fall asleep with the television on. It's a very easy thing for me to do because I did that for so many years with him. That was my company. I had a dog. I don't feel comfortable unless I have a dog in the house at night. And we always had a pet. And so the dog would become my companion and guardian. I never liked it, and I never quite got used to it.
Kim Rich is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Kim Rich is my guest. She's a writer who has a new memoir called Johnny's Girl, a daughter's memoir of growing up in Alaska's underworld. Your father was, in a way, a professional liar. I mean, you know, he ran a lot of con games. He did a lot of illegal things. Was he straight with you?
Sometimes. There's a contradiction in the way my father... on the one hand, my father was... he didn't try to hide who he was to anyone. That's the thing that became abundantly clear to me in doing the book, and the thing that I'm most proud of him now, and even then had a sense. I mean, he was not a hypocrite, and he would often rail about hypocrites. And so I knew, I mean, he didn't, like, when I was smaller, he didn't come out and explain, this is what father does for a living. I'm a professional gambler, and this is why I'm leaving the house at midnight. He never quite explained it to me, but certainly when I got older, he didn't try to hide it either.
Once you found out what it was your father did for a living, you begged him to stop. You begged him to stop gambling.
Right.
What was his reaction?
Well, I don't know. There was a period of time there when I was 14, a number of events were coming together. One was I was tired of living in the house with the gambling. Two, my father had a very violent temper. And up until my teens, he never really expressed it except in, you know, he'd have these fits. He'd throw things. He'd break things. He'd yell. He'd stomp around. When I became 14 or when I think I was 13, 14, he started hitting me. And it was a combination of that and the gambling in the house that I finally, I believe I got the idea from a junior high school counselor. I went to state authorities and asked to be taken out of the home. I don't remember an episode for example, of standing around saying, I want this out of the house, and him saying no, but there must have been many of those because it didn't happen until I left the house and went to the state.
It must have been very difficult to initiate hearings against your own father.
Absolutely. It was very difficult. And there was a problem, too, because essentially a lot of what he was doing was illegal. And right away, I think we went to one hearing, and we couldn't proceed until I had an attorney because they could not promise me that anything I would say would not be used against him. And that was very important to me. I did not want to be turning, I guess even then at the time, I didn't want to be turning against him in the same way that the police and prosecutors had been, you know, were always after him. There were very specific things I wanted, and one of them, of course, was not that he be arrested and not that he be, you know, charged with any crimes as a result of his activities.
Did your father try to talk you out of testifying against him and try to talk you out of leaving him?
He tried to talk me out of leaving him. I don't know. Testifying against him didn't seem to be the issue so much as he just wanted me to come back home. You know, my father was, for the most part, a loner. And he was, as I write in the book, he was born an outsider and remained one his entire life. And I think clearly the only relationship that endured for him and that meant the most was his relationship with me. And I think I've talked to people who told me it was very devastating for him when I up and left the house. And so he very much wanted me to come back home. In fact, as a friend told me later, he ran into my father and he said, John, where's Kim? And he said, she left me. And so he very much wanted me back home to the point of agreeing to go to family counseling. This was not the kind of thing that my father would do. Certainly sitting around with a stranger, you know, and discussing his family problems was not something he felt comfortable doing, but was willing to do it in the hopes that it would get me back home.
Sounds like a divorce, doesn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah.
So you got out, you know, you became a ward of the state. You ended up living in foster homes. And while you were living in a foster home, your father was murdered.
Actually, I had come out of the foster home and was living back home with him at the time of his murder. But when I moved back in with him at that time, I saw less and less of him. He had started up running two massage parlors, and he spent a lot of time there. From what I would hear him say is he had to keep an eye on the cash register. He couldn't cash, you know, trust the girls. I didn't see a lot of him the few months before his death, his abduction and then death.
Why was your father murdered? It's a long, complicated story. Maybe you can give us a kind of shorter version of it.
Sure. Essentially he was murdered because he had things that other people wanted. I mean, there's a couple different contexts to look at this. What was going on in Anchorage at the time is it was the year before they began construction on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It was going to make a lot of people rich. It was my father had set himself up in the massage parlor trade, anticipating that this would be a very lucrative business when some 70,000 men and women were used to build the pipeline over the 3 to 4 years that it took to build it. That's sort of the backdrop to what was going on. And he was looking at setting up massage parlors in Valdez, which is the southern terminus for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. His murder really was the result of he had gotten involved in a massage parlor that had previously belonged to another man who had been tried and acquitted in the murder of the previous owner. It gets a little complicated, but my father was brought in as a prosecution witness. He was subpoened to testify against a man named Wesley Ladd, who had owned the parlor my father owned prior to my father's taking it over. And I think that's where it all sort of began. Ladd wanted his parlor back. And furthermore, he felt that my father was richer and connected and all these things. Actually, he believed sort of the myth of my father as an underworld figure, that he was very rich, very connected, that he owned a great deal, when in fact he didn't own a great deal.
Was he connected?
No.
He was just a small time.
Right. In a very small time underworld. He was a major figure in Anchorage's underworld, which was very small time compared to many other places.
When your father was murdered, did it make you think that the world was a lot less safe than you ever thought?
Absolutely. That's why I think I refused to have anything to do with any of, you know, there was a lot of people I walked away. Well, my father didn't have much of an estate, if you will, to begin with, but I certainly didn't want anything. And I took a few pieces of his jewelry, costume jewelry at that, and left. I felt that that everything he owned was stained with his blood and that the life he led to his death. It was very, I couldn't have articulated it for you at the time. I was 15, but it was very frightening, I think, and very confounding. And I had enough good sense to know that I wanted nothing to do with it, while at the same time there was all kinds of people around me, people who knew him. He was married at the time to a woman that he had married not long before his death and who I write about in the book was quite young, and I did not get along with her. But, you know, there was all these people running around trying to get a piece of what Johnny Rich owned, his cars, his jewelry, his parlors, his businesses. And I simply wanted nothing to do with any of it.
When your father was murdered, you really tried to sever ties with him, cut yourself off from him and his past. You didn't even go to the funeral. Your mother had died years before that. After a series of institutionalizations, she became very sick. I believe it was cancer.
Yeah.
And she died. Did you have the same reaction to her death?
Yeah. The thing is, my mother, I had not seen her for, let's see, I last saw her when I was 9 and she died when I was 14. She actually only died a year before my father. But in many ways, as I describe it to people, I lost her when I was 6. I mean, that's when she had her full collapse and never really recovered from it. And, I mean, in some ways, really the person that I knew who had been my mother for the first 6 years of my life no longer existed after that. And I think that in many ways, when she died, it was sort of, how can I describe this? It was anticlimactic. It was as if she had died many years earlier, because I hadn't seen her in many years, and she was not the same person I had known as a small child.
Do you ever see angles where you could take advantage of somebody having learned from what your father did? Is it ever a temptation to do that?
No. I'm just the opposite of him. I take the slow road. Uh-huh. I'm very leery and wary of any fast buck schemes, of anyone who thinks they're going to get rich in a hurry, anyone who wants to... I mean, I went to college. I got a 4-year degree. I'm in graduate school. I worked for five and a half, six years as a journalist before I worked on this book. You know, I have no desire to work in business or, you know, in Alaska, real estate's a big field. You can make a lot of money in it. I'm not interested in it. I think having grown up with, in that environment has, you know, oddly enough, has created someone myself. I'm very stable in terms of my goals and what I want to do. So I guess it would only make sense when I used to jokingly say to people, and I say this only with very sardonically, but I used to grow up with two fears, that I'd end up like my mother, I'd end up like my father. And, I don't have those fears anymore, but I certainly think they guided me through a lot of my early adult years in terms of making deliberate choices that I felt kept me as far away from ending up, you know, as either of them did. Either as my mother, you know, of course I wouldn't have ended up like my mother. I don't have, you know, she suffered from a mental illness that I don't suffer from. But in the same sense, I always knew or always felt that I had to be very strong. I always felt that strength was something that I needed to have and to always display in order to avoid becoming sick as she did. Of course, now, after having done the book and the research, I realize that strength had nothing to do with it. But nonetheless, that was still a guiding principle in my life. As for my father, I sort of felt like the way he lived led him to his death, and I didn't want to live like that by any stretch of the imagination.
Kim Rich. Kim Rich is the author of Johnny's Girl, a daughter's memoir of growing up in Alaska's underworld. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the perils of acting. We talk with actor Ed Harris. He starred in The Right Stuff, Under Fire, and The Abyss, in which he nearly died shooting underwater scenes. Now he's an FBI agent in the new film, The Firm. And world music commentator Milo Miles tells us about a new strain of merengue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Bosnia's Serbian and Croatian factions are close to an overall agreement on dividing Bosnia into three ethnic mini-states, but they still have to decide on territorial boundaries. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli has more on the story.
Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic said in Geneva today he and his Croat counterpart Mate Boban have agreed on a military accord that includes a nationwide truce, demilitarization of Bosnia, as well as new principles for a transitional government. The announcement appears to further isolate Bosnia's Muslim president, Alija Izetbegovic, who has rejected a three-way ethnic partition of Bosnia, saying it legitimizes genocide. And Vice President Ejub Ganic has warned of a Muslim terror campaign in Europe if Bosnia is split up. But seven of Bosnia's 10-member collective presidency, including one Muslim, will go to Sarajevo tomorrow to try to convince Izetbegovic to at least consider the proposal. Earlier, Karadzic warned the Muslims to negotiate or be crushed by war and a two-way Serb-Croat division of Bosnia. This is Suvia Pojoli reporting.
According to news reports in Croatia, the government of Croatia is ready to extend a UN mandate for 10,000 peacekeeping troops if Serbian factions agree to accept a UN-sponsored peace plan. According to a letter sent to UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, Croatia would consider extending the mandate by up to half a year if a binding agreement is signed to put into force a peace plan proposed by mediator Cyrus Vance. The UN order is set to expire the first of next month. The National Academy of Sciences said today that the government should overhaul the way it tests pesticides to take into account the vulnerability of infants and children. Christopher Joyce has this report.
Children may be consuming more pesticides for their size than adults, according to a panel from the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. Children are also growing, the panel noted, which could enhance the effects of pesticide residues in food. Yet government regulators don't take this into account when they set maximum levels of pesticides allowed in fruits and vegetables. The panel's four-year study concluded that food is currently safe and that parents should continue to feed their children plenty of fruits and vegetables. But the government should overhaul its testing methods for pesticides, the panel advised, to head off potential problems. Joining the panel was a consumer organization, the Environmental Working Group, whose own study recommended that consumers ask their grocers to supply more low-pesticide foods. This is Christopher Joyce reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 39 points to close at 3,530.31 on volume of 240 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR News. Iraq has promised that it will strike back at the United States for a missile attack over the weekend on the government's intelligence headquarters. President Clinton says the strike damaged Iraq's intelligence operations and indicated to the rest of the world that the U.S. will be very aggressive in fighting terrorism. Iraqi officials have lodged a formal protest with the U.N. Security Council, accusing the U.S. of blackmail. Mr. Clinton said that he ordered the attack after officials determined that there was a plot to murder former President Bush on a visit to Kuwait in April. About 600 miles of the Mississippi River are closed to commercial barge traffic because of high waters. Officials also are warning pleasure boaters of the dangers of the treacherous current. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers closed another lock and dam along the Mississippi River today. Since last week, the Corps has shut down 21 locks between St. Paul and St. Louis. Tom Miller is a lockmaster with the Corps of Engineers.
The locks and dams have had to pull their machinery motors, and the water is getting high enough that the locks just had to shut down.
A barge industry group says there are more than 150 towboats with barges stranded on the upper Mississippi River. The water is expected to remain above flood levels for 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the weather. After more rain in Davenport, Iowa, National Guard troops are standing by with shovels and sandbags, prepared to hold back the floodwaters. I'm Kathy Lohr in Alton, Illinois.
Officials of Russia and Ukraine have signed an economic cooperation agreement. Prime ministers of the two countries met for the second time in 5 days in the matter. However, Ukraine's leaders warned against bringing back Soviet-style ties. One reason for the agreement appears to be a coal miner strike this month, where miners in eastern Ukraine called for closer ties with Russia. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The new film, The Firm, based on John Grisham's best-selling novel, opens this week. Tom Cruise stars as an ambitious graduate of an Ivy League law school who is wooed by a prestigious law firm. The firm offers incredible perks, but it wants a lot in return. Turns out this is a law firm in collusion with organized crime. My guest Ed Harris co-stars as an FBI agent who wants the young lawyer to help him infiltrate the firm. Harris played a salesman in Glengarry Glen Ross, John Glenn in The Right Stuff, and a mercenary in Under Fire. His most physically demanding role was in The Abyss, in which he played the foreman of an oil rig which is trying to rescue a sinking submarine. A lot of his scenes were shot underwater.
The thing about being underwater is if you don't have air, you're dead.
Right. You don't mean that metaphorically.
Right. And when you're on land, you usually generally have air around. And a lot of the time I spent down there in this what was called a fluid breathing suit, where I was supposedly breathing liquid oxygen. And I was just in a helmet full of water, pretending to breathe the water, holding my breath. And I didn't have any air supply of my own. I was, relying on a diver who would give me his regulator. I would fill up with air. He would swim away. They'd roll the cameras. I would hold my breath as long as possible, do whatever scene we were doing, signal out of air, and he would swim back by and give me air. And this is 40 feet underwater. It's dark. You can't see very well. I've got underwater contacts on to help me focus a little bit, but the bromine content of the water is such that you're down there for 10 minutes and your eyes start, being irritated. But I would be down there for 2 hours. I'd get out of there, look like I'd been in a ring with Mike Tyson, It just was tough because you're robbed of all your senses, uncomfortable. You're an actor and you're thinking, what am I doing down here, man? This is acting? This is like survival time, And if the guy with the air doesn't come, then you're in trouble,
Did that ever happen?
It happened once. He got hung up on a wire that had been strung between rehearsal and shooting, and I was kind of wondering what was going to happen next.
Well, what did happen next?
Well, it was really weird. I was on this rig. They were pulling me across the bottom of the tank with the camera tilted on the side so it looked like I was going down. It's very difficult to explain. But I had unhooked myself off this thing and got over to the wall. I was trying not to sink because I was negatively weighted a little bit. And I'm out of breath, And I signaled, and everybody knew that. But my guide got hung up on this wire. So I'm like clawing on this wall, trying not to sink to the bottom. At the same time, I'm totally out of breath. I can't see anything. And, you have to realize I'm out of breath. I'm out of air. I have no air. See, I'm talking to you because I'm breathing. But all during this time, I had no air to breathe. That's what's so hard about relating this story. Finally, this guy swims over, gives me a regulator. But he gives it to me upside down, which means you're breathing half air and half water.
Oh, God.
And I was really out of air, and I took a big gulp, and I got water, as well as a little bit of air. And I go, geez, what's that? That's not supposed to happen. And I thought maybe I hadn't purged the regulator. So what little air I got, I blew it back out, took another big breath, got water again, and I said, that's it. I'm a goner. I really figured that was the end. And then the cameraman, Al Giddens, swam over, ripped the regulator out of the guy's hand. He gave me his the right way and took a deep, I took a big breath and went, okay, that's better. But it was a little spooky there for a second.
So this guy saved your life?
Basically, yeah.
What did you say when you finally got up to the ground?
What did I say? I don't remember what I said. I remember it was decided that we weren't going to try that method of the shooting the scene again. We would make some changes.
Well, did you blow up? I mean,
no, I didn't blow up. I who are you going to get mad at? I mean,
I can think of a few people who you could start with.
Yeah.
I don't know. When something like that happens, you don't even think, you just kind of unload.
No, it was very strange because there was a part of me that was upset with myself for not being able to do this ridiculous thing, you know. No, I was very pissed off, but I didn't know where to vent it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember driving home that night in the car, just weeping, just going, you know, I don't know, it just was just going, what am I doing here? I'm an actor, you know, what is this? It was really weird.
No, what about Under Fire?
Mm-hmm.
And Under Fire was about journalists in, I think, an unnamed Latin American country that you assume was...
Nicaragua.
Nicaragua, yeah. And you were a mercenary who'd go... It starts off in Africa, and you're a mercenary there. Then you end up in this Latin American country. And you're a real hot dog in that film.
Yeah, I had a good time doing that.
Yeah, you're really lit in that.
A lot of people wondered what happened to me after that. They said, yeah, that was great, Ed, you know. Why didn't you ever play another part like that?
Tell me about how you prepared for that role.
I got in real good shape. I remember running on the beach in the heavy boots in the soft sand. And I read some books about guys like that, Soldiers of Fortune, and... basically went down there wanting to have a good time, because you know, I think Oates was generally enjoyed what he did.
You're just joining us. My guest is actor Ed Harris, and he's in the new film The Firm. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Ed Harris is my guest. He's starring in the new film, The Firm. Let me ask you about something that I know you have coming up. You're going to be co-producing and starring in a movie based on the life of the painter Jackson Pollock.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something that you initiated?
Well, it's something I've been interested in for a while. My dad works at the Chicago Art Institute now. And
teaching?
No, he works in the bookstore there.
Oh.
And he turned me on to Pollock about 6 years ago. Started reading about him, and trying to track down the rights to his story, and various books have been written, and anyway, I finally got in touch with Stephen Nafee, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Pollock. It's a great book. It's a wealth of information. It really is a definitive biography, and they also have... there are hours of interviews with Lee Krasner, which no one else is privy to.
She's the painter who was married to Pollock.
Right, she was married to Pollock and a pretty decent painter in her own right. So I just think the possibilities are overwhelming. I'm very excited about it. Pollock's struggle to find a mode of expression that was his own, that was not derivative, that was unique and, you know, fulfilled this... need he had to express himself, and a kind of dire need for attachment and love. I mean, it's just an incredible tale.
Has anybody else been cast yet?
No. Nope.
You going to cast for physical resemblance to the real people, or do you think that's not important?
I think part of the reality of Krasner's existence was she was not an attractive woman. And I think that that's important. Not that you have to cast somebody that is not a raving beauty or who can appear to be unattractive, as strange as that sounds. Not, I don't mean, it's hard to, I don't know, I'm kind of putting my foot in my mouth here or something, but I mean, that's a fact. She was not an attractive woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something about that that was a part of her character and a part of their relationship.
Now, you grew up in New Jersey. Your father, I believe, sang with the Fred Waring Orchestra on the Gary Moore Show?
No, Fred Waring was a separate thing. Fred Waring's Glee, in the Pennsylvanians.
Right.
I think there was actually, they finally did get on TV, I guess, in the early days of television.
Oh, I see. So they had their own show.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was Fred Waring. And then he was on the Perry Como Show.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We Get Letters.
Yeah. And then he was on the Gary Moore Show.
So what did he do on the Perry Como Show?
He was a singer.
The group that would back up Perry Como?
Yeah, they had
the
four men and four women. You
right.
Know?
Oh, boy.
Do the ooh-ahs in the background and do an occasional little number, Yeah.
Did you like that kind of music?
Perry Como, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, Perry's got a pretty mellifluous voice, you know. He's still singing, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, you could say Perry Como was why rock and roll had to come along.
You know, it's pretty, yeah, it's pretty white bread, you know, I mean.
So,
good way to put it.
Were there music wars in your house with you wanting to hear rock and roll and your father wanting to hear his kind of music?
Not really. No. I mean, they listened to what they wanted to, and I'd go in my room and listen to what I wanted to.
Do you have a favorite film of the films you've made?
Yes. A Flash of Green is my favorite film.
I haven't seen that.
It's made by Victor Nunez, whose film Ruby in Paradise won the Sundance thing this year.
Uh-huh.
We made it in 1983 in Florida. It's based on a John D. McDonald novel of the same name. And I just really feel good about it.
Is it out on video?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to find, but it is out on cassette. Blair Brown and Richard Jordan are in it, John Glover, some other people.
Oh, sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
It's about a reporter, actually.
Mm-hmm. And that's you,
mm-hmm.
Reporter?
Yeah.
Well, Ed Harris, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, anytime. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Ed Harris co-stars in the new film, The Firm. It opens this week. We heard Scott Hamilton on tenor saxophone. This is Fresh Air. The Supreme Court is moving fast to the end of its term and handed down another major decision today. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's that decision about and how will you cover it on All Things Considered?
Our own Nina Totenberg will be reporting on it for us, Terry, and this is a decision on redistricting. The court has ruled that the practice of redistricting in order to draw minority districts may impinge upon the rights of white voters. This affects specifically two southern districts, but it may affect as many as two dozen other congressional districts. We're also going to be talking about base closings, some more on the aftermath of the attack on Iraq, and why we used Tomahawk missiles instead of planes.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Modern merengue took shape in the 1950s on the island of Santo Domingo. It's a very lively dance music centered on accordion and saxophone. In recent years, it's become stiff competition for salsa in New York. World music commentator Milo Miles is charmed by a fresh style, merengue rap.
When two or more streams of music intersect, nobody knows what the result will be. You can get a muddy mess that doesn't honor any of the styles involved. Or you can get a bubbly mixture that flows its own way, even if for just a little while, before it disappears. When I tell world music fans that merengue rap is one of my favorite new inventions, I get a lot of wrinkled noses. The assumption seems to be that it must be some soulless, crass gimmick. And yet, salsa and hip-hop interacted from the start, and Latin rap has been a vital subculture for years. Although such judgments are always wildly subjective, I think merengue rap is even more ingenious than Latin rap because it's less pure, less likely to cross over, and more of its own quirky individual self. Get stupid, ponte travieso, kick the drum, mueve los huesos, y eso es así, de un lado para otro, de atrás para adelante, con un swing excitante smooth. Con mi voz arriba, el baseline, coge la iniciativa. Con un tono envidiable, un beat imparable, las críticas son admirables. Ajá, soul to soul, showtime, así que yo, let's go. Y prendan el salón con un toque de pop. Sígame and let's rock this place. Two particularly fine merengue rap albums are Todo Movido by Ruben DJ and Trego La Bamba by Vico C and Tonio Rosario. As with most dance records, the emphasis is on delectable fluff. Don't expect weighty masterpieces. After all, Vico C and Ruben DJ get their names on the cover for writing songs and producing, not rapping. In fact, true rapping only comes up in the arrangements now and then. You get much fast chanting over a beat and giddy scat singing. But the best thing a new form of music does is allow talented performers to play in an open field. Anything they can make fit the mix belongs here. Vico C seems to like Caribbean zouk music, and Ruben DJ sounds fond of 70s disco. People who like merengue without the accordion changed into a synthesizer should check out a pair of outstanding releases by Francisco Ulloa and Fafita La Grande. Both play in very sleek modern style, but with more conventional beats and instrumentation than the rappers. Francisco Ulloa's Ultra Merengue shows him to be a merengue classicist, with pinpoint arrangements, honey-coated melodies, and delightfully homey subjects. He features songs like The Little Water Jar, Homage to the City of Santiago, and of course, one called Ay Mami, that is, Oh Baby. Escucha, mi amor, las notas de mi canción. El recuerdo más querido que en mi sueño
muero contigo, muero contigo. Oye, mujer, por ti es que yo estoy así, bebiendo todas las noches sin poder dormir. Ay, mami,
ay,
ay, mami,
ay,
ay, mami,
ay,
ay, mami,
ay,
mi mamita chula,
ay,
esa que yo tengo,
ay,
mi mamita chula,
ay,
esa que yo tengo,
ay,
porque ya me paga,
ay,
todo lo que me bebo,
ay.
The "ay, mami" might apply to bandleader Fafita La Grande, who is an absolute firecracker that prefers two tempos, jet-propelled and faster than that. She might strike those unfamiliar with merengue's pace as a bit shrill and crazed, but once those dueling saxophone and accordion lines get a grip, she rips down all resistance. Her CD, called just Fafita La Grande, is the party monster of the season.
Myla Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how TV and the presidential candidates changed American politics in 1992. We talk with media and political correspondent for the LA Times, Tom Rosenstiel. He followed the ABC News team as it covered the last presidential campaign. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.